Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us today. Usually, the last Monday of the month is our dates for Steve Ackerman and John Martin to come in and talk about climate and weather. But since yesterday was a holiday, we gave them some time off and have them in now. And we'll talk about Wisconsin's weather and climate, and we're inviting you to join us as well in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. The month of May nearly over. Anything unusual about the month in terms of weather patterns, or just a typical month in Wisconsin?
It was a little bit. Temperature was above normal again by a few degrees, and precipitation is about normal. I think it's a little bit low in some areas. Soil moisture is also just about normal. So other than temperature, maybe we could call it a normal.
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty normal. No snowouts in the major leagues in the month of May. There were several in April.
So. That's right. That's right. Cleveland had to come to Milwaukee to play home games for a while.
I think all that stuff settled down, too. So.
Yeah. And it's pretty exciting. I mean,
do you have a summer forecast for the state of Wisconsin?
They were, and by they, I mean no. I was looking at a pretty average type of summer-type conditions. But I would go for a little bit warmer, just because it seems like they've all been warmer. But moisture-wise, it's kind of hard to predict what's going to be going on, just because we're so sensitive to thunderstorms and where they occur.
You know, Larry Mueller's been away in Canada playing golf for the last week, playing in a tournament up there. And while he's been away, workmen have been busy at his house. All of his work started with a hailstorm that did some damage the roof. And so that set about a major renovation of the entire house.
Funny how that works, huh? Yeah, roof damage and you're doing the whole house. Yeah.
There are only two authenticated deaths in this country from a hailstone impact that we're aware of. The first occurred outside Lubbock, Texas, when a man was caught in an open field and pummeled in 1930. The second occurred in Fort Collins, Colorado in 1979 when a hailstone struck a small child and 25 others were injured. Were you out in Colorado when this took place?
I was actually living in Colorado in 1979 and I was almost made that 25 injured to 26 because I was commuting up to the foothills and I was living downtown and I was commuting on a bus and I, you know, looked out. I took the bus down. I got off at campus and I looked up at the sky and it was green. And what a green sky tells you is, you know, nasty stuff is coming. So I had a choice. One was to cross the parking lot, which was at that time completely empty of cars. And it was a big parking lot where I could go up and sit in the union there and wait for the storm to go. And I decided to do that. And as soon as I got underneath cover, these big softball-sized hailstones started coming down on the parking lot. And I just looked out there and just thought, man, am I lucky. I decided to get some refreshments and not to cross that.
Good thing you were a chicken and didn't cross the road.
Well, if you'd like to get a question or a comment in about climate and weather, all you have to do is give us a call in Madison. It's 263-1890. Otherwise, 800-642-1234. And let's find out what's going on with Tom and Stoddard. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a theory. With the Arctic melting, and there's probably a lot more moisture up there, and I'm not sure if that would generate a low-pressure system up in that area, but here in Wisconsin, we have all this crazy, in the last few years, crazy, nutsy wind out of the south, and even a fair amount in the wintertime when you can expect that, oh, tomorrow it's going to warm up because you got all this constant wind out of the south. Any possibility of there being connection between that and the Arctic melting?
Well, one thing that doesn't have a connection is probably the amount of moisture in the air doesn't have a very big effect on the sea level pressure. It has some small, very small effect on the sea level pressure. So at the high latitudes where there usually are there usually is a moisture-starved atmosphere with a little bit of extra water around in the vapor form, may fractionally change the sea level pressure, but it's not going to be a major effect. And that's too far to our north anyway for that to affect the wind direction and speed here in Wisconsin. So I don't know if there's too strong a connection between the two in the story that you're telling, Tom.
Yeah, I haven't looked at what the wind direction and wind speed have been in terms of changes in the last 5 to 10 years.
Neither have I, so I don't know.
Recently, it seems like it's been coming out of the south a lot, but I don't know if it's just because I moved and therefore local conditions are affecting it or not. But it definitely seems like it's coming out of the south and where I live now.
Yeah, well, the lake is south of you, so there is the lake effect, right? But also, at this time of year, I mean, especially if you're paying attention now, you start to see a prevalence of southerly winds because the storm track moves to our north.
So that does make sense. Right. And the high pressure moves up, and so that's what brings all the moisture, too, and makes our summer's hot and moist.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of that's buried in the climatology, I think, at this time of year.
One additional question, since you mentioned the green in the clouds, and I've seen that oftentimes, and it does harbinger a crazy storm coming. Is that from refraction of the light in the clouds?
Yeah, exactly. It's the interaction of the sunlight with the particles within the cloud. And the latest theories, and notice I say this is what people are speculating, so I shouldn't say theory, this is still what people are speculating, is that in order to get that green color, you need big particles, like big hailstones, but also a lot of small particles in there as well, which makes sense because, when you have large hailstones, generally they're going to be collecting water, and one way to do that efficiently is to have a whole bunch of small particles in there, of liquid water. So that's the latest thoughts on what causes the green thunderstorms.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much for your call, Tom. We appreciate hearing from you. You know that nitrogen oxides, the reactive gases that contribute to smog, are partly made by cars and trucks. You may not know that these gases are also made by lightning. I didn't know that, John.
Yeah, there's other gases and chemicals that are made in the presence of lightning. One of them is cyanide. Is made, and also
I bet you didn't know that.
A couple of other organic molecules are made in the presence of lightning. So it's pretty interesting how lightning can cook up the mixture of otherwise inorganic chemicals into something that's rather interesting. I don't know how much of the nitrous oxide budget is contributed by lightning, and also where it's being produced is important, because when you produce it in the lowest part of the atmosphere, especially in places where you tend to have what's known as an inversion, like the Central Valley of California, that becomes a major pollution issue. Mm-hmm. If you produce it in the free atmosphere well above the surface, it probably isn't such a big deal in terms of contributing to pollution and smog. But when it's produced near the ground, it's a pretty big factor. And so I'd guess that lightning, though it might produce some of these nitrous oxides, is not really producing them where it counts in terms of contributing to pollution. What do you think about
that, Steve? And you'd be right.
Is that right?
Yeah, because lightning contributes about 5 to 10% of the nitric oxides, the NO and NO2s, in the atmosphere. And that gets converted at high. I mean, basically what it's about is that there's a lot of nitrogen in the atmosphere, and that nitrogen can get oxidized into NO and NO2, but it requires high temperatures. Mm. And so the two common ways of doing that is through lightning or through automobiles. Lightning tends to be distributed throughout the troposphere, so it'll generate these NOXs throughout the entire troposphere, but its peak is in the middle regions of the atmosphere and not down low.
Yeah.
And most of the nitrous oxides that are produced down low are produced by cars.
Yeah,
and
combustion.
Right, and that's the bad kind. It's like ozone. Ozone, there's the good. I like to think of it as the good and the bad.
Right.
Bad kind is down at the surface because ozone's really reactive and it bothers our eyes and our respiratory systems. And then there's the good kind, which is the stuff that's up in the stratosphere away from where we live that shields us from ultraviolet radiation.
Yeah, and they're not the same. I mean, this is such an important point, and it seems like a rather esoteric scientific point, but where these chemicals are produced has everything to do with what role they play in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be people who will unfairly say, well, lightning produces as much nitrous oxide as combustion in automobiles, so why should we start to regulate what comes out of the tailpipe of a car? And it's just not a fair argument. It's
right.
totally
yep.
unfair.
Yep.
So you can't really even make a link between lightning and global climate change, let's say, as some people might try to do.
I think that's probably not safe ground to stand on, because lightning's been occurring throughout the Earth's history, mm-hmm. and I don't think there's any evidence that there's an increased amount of lightning around in the atmosphere, and therefore it can't be contributing to any of the changes in the chemistry or in the response to the chemistry that the atmosphere is currently experiencing.
You know, Larry Mueller and I were up in Bayfield 2 weeks ago to do a remote up there, and you couldn't help but notice as you're driving into Bayfield how low the water level of Lake Superior is.
Mm.
We've talked a little bit about this in past programs, but any explanation for why this continues to drop? And some marinas were having difficulty getting some of those larger yachts out into the water.
Hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah, I know Lake Superior and Lake Michigan are both down below normal. And it's just, you know, those lakes are just, as with any lakes, it's just a matter of supply and, or I should say, sources and sinks. Hmm. Where are you getting the water from and, you know, how are you losing it? The watershed for the Great Lakes is actually surprisingly small.
It's incredibly small. It's almost the size of the footprint of the lakes. It's really hardly bigger than that.
Right, yeah. It's not very big. And so unless you get a lot of snowfall to replenish them, the sources just don't overcome the sinks.
Yeah, you know, and the big lakes don't freeze over, and so they're susceptible to evaporation all winter long. So if things are warming up just enough to limit the amount of snow that's imported from other parts of the world, not just generated in the lee of the lakes or in the, you know, lake effect snows, because that's recycled water from the lake. That's not going to help. Mm-hmm. But if you're not bringing in new snow from large-scale weather systems and you're allowing a little bit more evaporation because the lakes have a little bit less ice on them every year, I think the accumulated effect of that is you start to lose water and you notice it.
Yeah. So.
I had a listener write to me and ask, why do we pay so much attention to the Great Lakes when you consider that the Great Lakes compare that with the Mississippi River and other large rivers in the world? Why do we focus on the Great Lakes when it is a tremendous source of water for millions of people in the basin that it serves? But I couldn't come up with an answer for him.
Wait, I'm sorry, why don't we or why do we?
Why do we pay so much attention?
Because we live here now. Yeah. I'll tell you, when I lived on the East Coast.
You didn't care, right?
Didn't, right. I mean, it was nice to know the names. And actually, we did care about Lake Erie and Lake Ontario because they bordered our state. Yeah. Actually, moving to Wisconsin, I've been now fascinated with the Great Lakes and, you know, how they got here and what their water levels are and what the cycling of them are. It's they're actually really interesting great bodies of water, and they're huge
they're
in terms
gigantic.
Of freshwater bodies.
I think Lake Superior has 20% of the world's fresh water or something astronomical like that. Mm-hmm, I mean, it's deep and huge. And fresh water is a particularly precious resource for the world, not just our own country in Canada. And so, you know, the health of these lakes and keeping that water fresh and keeping it healthy is a very important issue. I'm not a limnologist. I don't know much about the lakes, but I agree with Steve. Having moved here and seen them, how can you not be interested in them?
Speaking of limnologists, John Magnuson, emeritus professor of UW-Madison, will be here on Thursday to talk about regional effects of global warming.
Oh, excellent.
So looking forward to that. We're going to pause and catch up with the latest news from NPR and then come back and answer your calls with Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about climate and weather with Steve Ackerman, who directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the UW-Madison, and John Martin, chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. And between them, they've made many appearances now. It's the last Monday of the month, usually, at 11:45 for the two of them, but it's great to have them here today.
Yeah, it's great to be here, as always.
We've been doing it since, like, 1997.
Yeah, long time.
It's, you know,
long
time.
10 years.
Yeah,
holy mackerel.
Wow.
10 years in July, that's
Where
right.
did it go? If you'd like to join the conversation, and we're looking for people with questions, I will frankly tell you that. In Madison, the number is 263-1890, or elsewhere, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. That is a toll-free call. And, of course, our email address is talk@wpr.org. Let's go to the phones to Robert in West Allis next. Hello, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen.
Hi, Robert.
I remember very clearly the drought that we had throughout Wisconsin back during the Dust Bowl in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm an old farmer at heart, because when I see the dry weather that we are experiencing this spring, the very dry April, and seeing the lawn beginning to turn brown without watering, it kind of worries me. I'm just kind of wondering, is this a phenomena that is associated with normal cyclical weather patterns, or is there some implication as far as global warming is concerned?
That's probably a hard one to answer, Robert. We're experiencing quite the opposite here in the southern part of the state. We're, you know, nobody's lawn's turning brown, not even close yet. It's been really a nicely, moderately wet spring, I think. It hasn't been excessively wet, but it certainly hasn't had a long period of drought either. So what you're testifying to is pretty regional. I don't know off the top of my head how it's going across the whole central plains of North America. That would be, of course, a manifestation that one might be able to be, or at least be tempted to, link to some global change. But I'm not sure if that's been the case. In the preceding few years, I know it's been very dry in Oklahoma, Panhandle of Texas, and western Kansas. But I think that was alleviated largely late this winter and early this spring. And so I'm not sure they're in any severe situation, at least is not as severe as they were last summer and last fall. But I don't know anything more than that.
Yeah, I mean, for the western region, there are pockets in the western regions that are still, you know, now when I say western regions, I mean the mountain regions that are still having droughts. But I think with regard to Wisconsin and the upper Midwest, if you are seeing a drying area in a particular region, it could be just natural variability at this point. I think we'd have to look at more time go by to determine whether or not we're going to end up with a really drought summer or anything. Yeah. But I don't think people are predicting.
The lake levels seem to be dry, lower, because they're even worried about the shipping on the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether that's a problem. They're draining too much water out, or whether it's just not enough water coming in from the heavens.
I think it's a combination of that. Losses either due to draining it or to evaporation, and really not getting enough in. I mean, the Great Lakes, particularly Lake Michigan, has been down since about 97.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, that was when we had a El Nino-type event, and we didn't get very much precipitation up there. And it seems like ever since then, they've been down below normal.
Robert, thanks very much for the call and for that line of inquiry. Speaking of El Nino, where are we in terms of El Nino at this time?
You know,
I think we relaxed back to about normal, in the tropical Pacific. So there's not much of a signal, positive or negative, right now in terms of those equatorial ocean temperatures. And it's also longitude-based, so it's in the eastern Pacific where we start to get nervous if it warms up there. So I think that things have relaxed back to normal. We had a modest, and probably even weaker than modest, event over the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
And the prediction at the time was that it was going to relax back, and I believe that's been the case.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't remember hearing any big news about it anyway, which if it was getting stronger, we would know that.
Sierra in Madison, let's give you a chance. Hello.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon. I seem to be noticing, instead of normal spring weather, a lot of severe up-down cycling, kind of a summer-fall, summer-fall, summer-fall thing, and other people have been talking about it too, a kind of a seesaw weather. I'm wondering if that is, you know, proven in the statistics. And I also was wondering, is there some place that those statistics are available in terms of not just the temperature, but kind of maybe a graph showing how local weather has been temperature-wise? Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you can get that kind of information from the Wisconsin State Climatologist's webpage. And I'll try and recall the address as I'm talking to you about the other thing. The other is this time of year, the month of May particularly, is one in which you do get, like days like today, where it'll be nearly in the mid-80s and quite humid. It feels summery out there. And then that can be preceded or followed by a day where the temperature falls back to what's normal climatological high around this time of year is about 68 or 69 degrees. So that feels a lot more autumnal. And it's not until you get into the second week maybe of June where you really start to say goodbye to those excursions of temperatures barely getting to 70. That doesn't happen so frequently after about the 10th of June. But up till now, this has been quite a normal progression of warm and muggy for a couple of days, and then when the air mass changes, it usually changes with something that's come out of high Arctic Canada, and that's pretty chilly and usually quite dry, and the visibilities go up, the sky is a deeper blue, all of those things. That happens a lot in the month of May, so that's rather normal, actually.
And in addition to the Wisconsin Climate Office that John is still thinking about. If you go on the internet and just search on Midwest climate, you'll also come up with there's an organization of state climatologists that are grouped together in the Midwest climate, and you'll get it for the entire upper Midwest region.
Yeah, and I can't think of the address specifically, but I think you could, if you go to Google and you just put Wisconsin State Climatologists office, it'll go right to that page. That'll be the only thing that'll meet that search criteria. And that's a really good source for a lot of information. You find it very interesting.
Yeah.
All right, Sierra.
Great.
Thanks very much. We appreciate your call. And we have lines open for your call, your comment, or question in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. You know, living here in the Midwest, we don't spend a lot of time talking and asking about hurricanes, but the forecast for the hurricane season was unveiled a couple of weeks ago. And yeah. What are we looking for in the next few weeks and months?
We're looking for about 6 to 10 named hurricanes coming, which is a little bit above average. And looking, I think they're predicting three or so of Category 3 and above, which are some of the severe ones. So we'll see if they come right. Generally, they've been pretty good, except for 2005, they really blew it, and 2006, they really do it.
So we don't have any confidence in their
I don't know. I'm getting a little shaky now because 2005 was way above average, so you would expect that that they would miss something that's such an outlier. But then 2006, they predicted more than normal, and they didn't get it. And this year, they're predicting more than normal, and we'll see. You know, and you get, that's two strikes, you know.
That's right.
We're very
that's
unforgiving right. with forecasting.
It's 0-2, and they've got, right. and nature always has a good closer. So right. you don't want to be 0-2.
Forget about the previous 10 years. It's those last two. And it.
Our guests are Steve Ackerman, directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the UW-Madison. And talk about new satellites, new availability for people like yourselves to study weather conditions around the world.
Yeah, we got two really new satellites up there that are really cool, I think. Of course, by cool, you know, it's they were launched about a year ago. We're actually getting into the data now and analyzing it. And these are what we call active sensors. So every night on the evening news, when you look at the satellite imagery, those are generated by what we call passive instruments, where they're just measuring the incident radiation that's on them. And in these active sensors, they actually send out a beam of light, and they look at how it interacts with the atmosphere. And what that allows us to do with these active approaches is get vertical distributions of, for example, clouds and aerosols, whereas in evening noon, we see the horizontal distribution. So now we can accurately detect where the clouds are in the vertical, where the cloud tops are and where the cloud bases are. One of those instruments is a LIDAR, which is light detection, and the other one is a radar using radio waves to detect the presence of where clouds are vertically. Mm. And some of that data that's coming out is just really, really exciting. It's really cool.
And another exciting thing about satellite meteorology is now that it's now 25 on going on 30 years of information from space, it's becoming a major climate record, which is fantastic. You know, up till now, we haven't been able to say much with confidence about cloud climatologies, things like that. But now we've got data that we can really mine to say important things about that, which I think is a huge advantage.
And you really need that.
Because
it's the only observation to get things globally. Because otherwise, you know, we don't have many people living in the middle of the Pacific Oceans or in the middle of the oceans, and that's 70% of the planet.
Yeah, and we find some of those places are the most critical places for weather systems, and they may well be critical places for the climate system.
Yeah.
All right, back to the phones. Bob in Menominee is next. Hello, Bob.
Hello. Hi, gentlemen.
Hello. Hi, Bob.
Just an observation. I'm a young 48, and thinking back in the past where rain events seem to happen every 2 to 3 days, and we'd have a, quote, average year for precipitation. Nowadays, both winter and summer, it seems like we make up for our average in one or two huge events. Is that somewhat tied to global climate change or just cyclical patterns? Do you see the same patterns happening that are different from, I'm thinking, the old days?
Well, it's interesting. My suspicion is this. That I think in the wintertime, people tend to recollect more snow than in the old days than they do now. And then in the summertime, it seems that people recollect less rain, less intense, you know, gully washer rains in the old days than they do now. Then I think the evidence points to something in the middle in both cases. We're not really getting a lot less snow now or a lot more snow, a lot less snow now or a lot more rain in the summertime thunderstorm weather than we used to. So I'm not sure that there's really a very strong signal there. It might be clouded by recollection. My own recollection is the same way. I remember heavier snows when I was a kid, but I think when I look at the data, I always find that it's just not the case. There's a little bit of psychology involved there, but I don't know. Maybe Steve knows.
I mean, I distinctly remember more snow winters than when, you know, than when I'm adult, that's for sure. And I don't know, again, as John's saying, whether or not it's just cloudy. That's just remember those days off from school,
which are exciting
and things like that.
They're huge spikes
right.
in your memory.
Yeah, but they are, I know that with regard to predictions of what a warmer climate would bring, for what it's worth, and I really emphasize for what it's worth, because there's not a lot of evidence that really demonstrates this yet. People are predicting that summertime precipitations will come in more erratic type events. So rather than getting rains every 2 to 3 days of calmness, we'll be getting heavy rains.
Once a week.
More frequently.
And that kind of thing happens already in Louisiana, Mississippi.
That's
so
right.
I guess what it means is it's a march northward of some of that more, what we traditionally consider a southern climate, where that is exactly how precipitation is delivered to them, in huge doses in short periods of time and then a couple of days of clear and nice.
So it's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
Okay, Bob.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, appreciate your call. And on to Martin in Milwaukee. Martin, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I call from the past season. Is there any scientific classification of snow besides wet snow, dry snow, yellow snow?
You mean snow with oxides?
Yeah.
Boy, when it gets on the ground, I'm remembering now from the days of when I lived in Colorado, and that's making me think that, yes, there is classifications, because in Colorado, it was really critical in terms of knowing the type of snow you had up there in order to predict avalanches.
Yeah, same in Washington State.
But we don't have avalanches in the Midwest very much. So.
But I think, you know, all of that stuff, if I remember right, because one of my roommates from graduate school was the avalanche forecaster in Seattle. He may still be. And one of the things that it follows from is the crystal habit that you get.
Right,
there are a variety of different kinds of crystals, and if you pay attention to snow falling, you can even see this sometimes. They look like needles occasionally. Columns look like needles to the naked eye. And then there are the traditional kindergartner making a Christmas card for his parents, dendrites. And there's all kinds of other combinations of those. But those are all temperature dependent. And then they all have a different sort of cohesion in a large pile of snow, too. So that might be part of what feeds into the avalanche forecast view. You have to know what sort of snowflakes are falling to know something about their structural integrity in a big pile. So there is some classification.
Yeah, there's certainly classification for when it's in the atmosphere. And I think also when it gets on the ground, part of the classification or the changes in the shapes that John's talking about is a function of the temperature changes that the snow goes through. Because I remember there are certain temperature changes that cycle around that actually make the snow crystals that are on the ground more round. And when you do that, then now you know it's going to be like ball bearings, and that's the bad thing for avalanches. But I totally forget what the conditions are for that. Mm. Okay. Do you know?
Martin?
Yeah, Martin?
I was just wondering if these are recorded anywhere.
I'm sure the snow type would be available on the Internet someplace, and we certainly recorded in the mountain regions of the U.S.
Yeah, so if you Google types of snow or snowflakes or something like that.
Yeah, I would go types with snow. Yeah. If you do snowflakes, you're probably going to get the classification that John just talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Second question. Living near Lake Michigan, I find the forecast, there'll be a front coming through the state, and they'll say the front is slowing down because of a dry wedge near Lake Michigan, and I always wonder, how can you have a dry wedge of air over one of the largest water bodies on Earth that keeps a weather front from coming through and bringing you rain?
Yeah, I would never make such a forecast, and I'd certainly never construct such a sentence because it is it seems not right to me. I can imagine a retardation of a temperature change under certain conditions. You know, the temperature change associated with the front, because you might have a lake breeze, let's say in the middle of June, where the wind is coming off the lake, is a little bit warmer than maybe some cool Canadian air that's trying to invade behind the front. And that lake breeze will keep the front, will slow it down just a little bit. But I don't consider it, you're right, it can't be drier air coming in off Lake Michigan from the east. That's just not possible.
I thought maybe if it's a warm front coming in, there might be a dew point change over the lake because it's cooler compared to the warm air, humid coming in off the...
That's possibly true, but the warm fronts make progress in a way that it's not going to be affected by that.
Okay.
So,
all right, Martin. Thanks very much. We do appreciate your call. Matson in Madison is next. Hello, Matson.
Hi. Good afternoon. Yeah, my question is about the major contributions of global warming and how, you know, the mass media has really kind of grasped onto this whole idea and kind of even made it into a scare at some time. I apologize for my cat if you can hear him in the background. but I'd like to see if you have any discussion about that and maybe separating, you know, the fact from the fiction and really those kinds of ideas. And then also if you could even look at, more of a, if this is a cyclical route that global warming might be taking over the past, you know, millennia even, or if this is something that really we should be concerned about, and if it's, you know, something that's not following the typical trends. And I know it's hard to follow, you know, be able to look at data because, you know, we've only really had good technical data for the past maybe 150, 200 years. You know, it's really, you can't really go off of any kind of recordings from the past, you know, 1,000 years or anything. So I guess, long story short, if you could talk about the global warming and just the epidemic. Thank you.
Yeah, you're right that the instrument record only goes back good for about a century or so. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that temperature record, what you find is that the last couple of decades, there has been a really rapid warming of the atmosphere. So that's what I would say is a fact, that we've seen a rapid warming that we haven't seen since the instrument records have been taken. The other fact that we've been getting now is that when we look into the past, how we infer climate is like a big detective story. You know, you need to kind of find all these little evidences and then kind of put together a picture that makes physical sense and obeys the physical laws. And one of the important means of doing that, there are a variety of different ways, like tree rings and drills and bogs and things like that. But more recently, we've been looking at ice cores, both in Greenland and Antarctica. And those ice cores can actually, by analyzing the bubbles of air that are trapped in there, we can analyze the chemistry of those bubbles and of the ice, and that gives us an indication of what the temperature structure looks like. And you're right in that as we go back 600,000 years, there is a cyclical cycle in temperature and amount of carbon in the atmosphere. But that cyclical cycle in terms of the temperature changes doesn't match the type of change we've been seeing over the last few decades. Hmm. And so the indications is that humans are playing a role in the last 100 years or so in terms of affecting our global climate. And again, part of that picture is not just the data, it's just now how do we put that together in a physical evidence. And the physical laws that then make this picture look true and acceptable are that the amount of carbon that we're putting in as a society, more global, is increasing, the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, and physically we would expect that that carbon is going to make the atmosphere warmer. And warmer atmosphere means that there's more moisture in the atmosphere, and more moisture in the atmosphere means that we're going to get warmer again. And so that all that picture generally holds together.
Yeah, and Steve's pointing out the fact that the instrumented record goes back only a century and a half or so, but the proxy record goes back hundreds of thousands of years. And as Steve points out, great ways, very smart people have figured out how to make sense of that proxy record by pollen, tree rings, ice core data, chemicals in the air, through those bubbles in the ice. And whenever the CO2 content in the atmosphere goes up, the temperature goes up. And we've not seen an increase as rapid in the CO2 content of the atmosphere as we've seen in the last, I guess, 50 or 60 years. And the committant increase in the temperature is corresponded to that CO2 increase. In addition, you can make a clear case, and there's no folly in it, that the amount of CO2 has gone up in proportion to the burning of fossil fuels.
Right.
And that's true in the modern era. We don't know what might have played the biggest roles in the CO2 increases and decreases in the past, but this current increase in CO2 is directly connected to fossil fuel combustion. And so most of the fictions are on the side of people who are saying this is not a concern and that this is just part of a global pattern and don't worry about it and business as usual. That's a fiction. The fact is, we need to be much more concerned about this than we've been in the past 20 years.
These temperatures that we're seeing now, have those actually already surpassed the past cyclical highs and lows that you found in over the past, you know, couple millennia or even thousands of years?
Oh, is the global average temperature warmer now than it's ever been? No, it is not.
Yeah. But the key is not just the magnitude, but actually the rate of change.
That's the
that's the things that all hang together, that this is not necessarily a natural phenomenon.
Mattson, thank you so much for the call. One last call from Mark in Madison. Mark, what can we do for you?
Well, I'm really disappointed to hear that there's new satellites and equipment coming on board for forecasting, because my observation has been the more equipment they get, the less accurate the forecast has been. And the last, I get my regular forecast from Milwaukee, and it's really become unreliable. We had to put a window in the weather room over there and just look out and tell you what's happening.
Mark, thanks for the observation. We'll pick up on that topic next time that the gentlemen are in. We ran out of time, and I cannot allow you to respond to that.
Right.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests, they're here on the fourth Monday of the month, which means they'll be back on the last Monday of June at 11:45, and we'll take up that question of whether new satellites means a worse forecast. Thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air phone production. I'm Jim Packard. Larry Mueller's back tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.